The Reverend Ralph A. Bowman is serving his fourth term as president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Before first being elected in 1981, he was the president of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis from 1975 to 1981. He is a 1951 graduate of St. John's College, Winfield, Kansas, and was graduated from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis in 1956, and earned a PhD from Yale University. He has served as pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Des Moines, Iowa, from 1958 to 1960, and was assistant pastor at Grace Lutheran Church, Pagedale, Missouri, from 1961 to 1971. Dr. Bowman joined the St. Louis Seminary faculty as professor of systematic theology in 1960 and remained in that position until 1981. He was executive secretary of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations of the Synod from 1971 to 74, and from 1965 to 1971 and 1975 to 1981, he was a member of that commission. He served on the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod American Lutheran Church Commission on Fellowship from 1969 to 1981. Dr. Bowman has written numerous books, articles, and documents with particular emphasis on interchurch relations and biblical interpretation. He and his wife, Pat, have two grown children, Paul and Lynn. Therefore, it is an honor to welcome to our campus the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. Ralph Bowman.
Well, thank you for your kind introduction, and thank you for your warm welcome. If you were listening to all of that stuff that they always say, you heard, in case you don't know me, that 21 years of my life and ministry were spent at this beautiful seminary, not counting the years it took me to graduate. It's always been a special pleasure to come back to the campus, to see my many friends and colleagues on the faculty, students. You look just as good as you ever did. And what a delight it was this morning to, I got there a little bit late, but to worship with you on the Festival of the Reformation. Can't think of a better place to be, and I can't imagine a service of praise and thanksgiving more fitting for the day than what we did together this morning. Bill Schmelder, if I can, Bill, are you here? Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for that good word. I notice you're learning how to preach, and it's an annual tradition when I come out to visit with students that I always twit Bill. Bill and I were colleagues and co-workers in the administration back in the 70s, and I don't hesitate to say it in front of him. I think he's one of the finest law gospel preachers in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and I personally am just deeply touched by the way he addresses God's law to my heart and especially God's gospel. I walked into chapel, Bill, the first sentence I heard was the Reformation. It was about the gospel. As I recall, you had a little more enthusiasm in your voice than I just managed, but thank you for the good word, and thanks for the fellowship we enjoyed at the altar this morning. Thanks for being here as students of theology and future pastors of the Church of Jesus Christ. Over the years, I have found that students and I enjoy just visiting. So I generally come unprepared, except to answer questions. And that's my theory again this morning. I can probably stay a little beyond the 11:30 time if you can. I would like to say just a few words about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and its ministry, if I may, by way of introduction to your questions. When you ask questions, though, I would invite you to range anywhere you want to. Don't hesitate to make some suggestions as well. I'm told that seminary hasn't changed all that much, that professors and students still have suggestions for how the president of the church and the folks at the International Center, and all of us could serve the church more effectively. So please feel free to make suggestions, ask questions, and we'll have a good visit. One of my favorite statements of the Reformation is Thesis 62 of Dr. Luther's, and I got to the sermon too late to know whether Bill quoted it at the beginning of his sermon. The true treasure of the church is the gospel of the glory and grace of God. The context, I'm sure, was somewhat antithetical, because in Luther's campaign at that time against the indulgent system of the church, the Western medieval church, he had to deal with something called a treasury of merits, a kind of a formal concept where the extra works of the saints and others were kept to be applied through the sacramental system of the church to the religious needs of people. And there's a point by way of antithesis to that concept. I'm sure in Luther's words, the true treasury of the church, or the true treasure of the church, is the gospel of the glory and grace of God. But those words, which focus very simply on words easy to understand, have never been more needed than they are today. The true treasure of the Church of Jesus Christ, and therefore of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and of those who serve it as pastors and teachers and faculty members, remains the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. We in the Synod these days have been focusing on words that try to help our people zero in on the fundamental nature of the church and its mission. Some may recall that in our last synodical convention, we chose as the theme of our synodical life and work these days the words that we sing in the canticle after returning from the altar, after receiving the Lord's body and blood, and in response to that gift, we sing, "Thank the Lord and sing his praise, tell everyone what he has done." And we chose those words, "tell everyone what he has done," because they seem so apropos and so helpful to many, many people in our church, to say it simply, what we're all about in the church. Our task is to tell. Some churches think the task is better defined in terms of activity, perhaps some kind of peace and justice activity, some kind of social action. We get confused on that all too easily. The task of the church remains to tell. Through word, through deed, through witness, through art, through music, through every device and instrumentality known to man, our task is to tell. And what we tell is what he has done. Our tendency is to focus on what we have done in a spirit of pride or accomplishment, or sometimes in despair. But our telling to the world is what he has done, not only in creating us, but especially in redeeming us and in sanctifying us, and day by day through word and sacraments, forgiving us, restoring us, giving our life ministry and our life a direction toward the heavens above. And the audience of our telling what he has done is nothing less than everyone. First, in some sense, we tell one another. That's what education in the church, that's what worship in the church, that's what many of the programs in the church are all about, telling each other in the Christian church what he has done. And I know the doctrine people among you, and that should be all of you, I think, recognize in that the doctrine of the means of grace, that in the telling of what God has done in Jesus Christ through word and sacrament, God's Spirit is joined to word and sacrament, and God gives life and power and meaning to his people. So we tell everyone within the church what he has done. But they are words that speak especially to our hearts about the tremendous number of people in this world who don't know Jesus Christ. Depending on whose statistics you use, the estimate ranges somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of this world's 5.1 billion people who do not know Jesus Christ. And in a preeminent way, the telling of what he has done for them and for us and for our salvation is a task directed to those people outside the Church of Jesus Christ. Well, that theme has been a wonderful theme for us in the boards and commissions and the districts of the Synod. It says it in such simple terms, what we're all about. We have then chosen four other words to be sort of the contours of an impressionistic painting of what the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod might look like if we were all telling everyone what he has done as well as we could do it. Those words are gospel. We say we want to be gospel-based as a church. We want to be mission-driven, to measure our activities in terms of what they do, to bring forward and work on the great commission of our Lord to make disciples of the nations. We say that we want to be congregation-centered, not St. Louis-centered, not hierarchy-centered, not top-down, but that we exist to help congregations worship, preach, proclaim, celebrate, teach all that he has done. And then we say finally that we're a church that as we go about this work is a people-oriented church, not primarily institution-centered, not primarily talking about the Synod and its programs and its structures and its officers and its committees and its various ways of doing things, but talking about people, the needs of people, the people who are alienated from each other, people who are in need of our help in special ways, whether you talk about the unborn or the poor or the victims of injustice. People. People means helping pastors. I would love to respond to comments later on about that. Pastors, as they carry out their ministries, need personal love and respect and attention, and we're trying to focus more on relationships that will build them up. People in terms of male and female, people in terms of old and young and rich and poor and wise and simple, but a people-oriented church. Well, these four terms have begun to characterize what this church might be if we put all of our energies and enjoyed God's blessings, as he always does, as we go about telling everyone what he has done. I don't have time, nor perhaps do I need, to try to spell out all the practical implications of what this means for life in the Synod, but I would like to focus for just a few moments on that first and most basic word in that attempt to paint a picture of the Synod telling everyone what he has done. And that's where Thesis 62 and Word 1 come into play. The true treasure of the church is the gospel of the glory and grace of God. We want to be a gospel-based church. We want to do better those things that we've already done well in proclaiming and teaching and celebrating and sharing the good news of God in Jesus Christ. When we say we want to be a gospel-based church and that we want pastors in this church who are centered in the gospel, we're saying many things. We're saying, for example, that the spiritual needs of people are foremost in the times in which we live. We're saying that there's a spiritual hunger in our society and sometimes in our church, sometimes in our ministerium. We're recognizing by focusing on the good news, as Professor Schmelder preached it so eloquently and powerfully and personally this morning, we are saying to one another, let us be consciously a spiritual church, ministering the gospel to the spiritual needs of people. With those words, we're saying that we continue to want to be a doctrinal church, and that we understand doctrine not to be some addition to gospel. Doctrine is the explication and the understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It is simply taking John 3:16, beginning with the first verse, first word, if you will, and moving from God to eternal life. Doctrine is the explanation of our confession of the gospel drawn from Holy Scripture. And we want to continue to be a strong gospel church because that means we're going to continue to be faithful to the doctrine of the Scriptures as we know them in the Lutheran confessions. To say that we want to be a gospel-centered church is to say that other things aren't going to be in the center. Structure, organization, institution, or even the law. We have a tendency in the Missouri Synod to, perhaps not limited to us either, to allow law once in a while to creep in there, to create new orders, to create new ways, new programs, to cater to the innate assumption of man that somehow by our doing we can make the kingdom come. No, the true treasure of the church is the gospel of the grace and glory of God. To say that is to recognize that our people, even though they are heirs of the Reformation, continue to believe in astonishingly high numbers that the gospel is really God's rules for right living. And to quote one definition from the Strumman Survey of 1972, repeated again in 1982, 40%, 2 out of 5 American Lutherans believe that the gospel has to do with doing things right, with obeying God's law. That's in the congregations that you will pastor, as well as in other congregations. To be a gospel-based church is to recognize that it's God who gives the blessing in terms of proclamation. It's to say it isn't statistics, it isn't numerical achievement, it isn't organizational know-how or catchy programs or phrases that are the answers to being a lively church. No, it's the gospel that's the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. It's dunamis. It has the very strength and energy of God himself in our ministering of it. So, when we talk about being a gospel-based church, we are laying out for ourselves a priority that can be second to none. And I mention what may seem very obvious to you, this emphasis, because I urge you to make it your own as you study, as you teach, to resist those temptations to substitute something else at the heart of the church's ministry. To be a gospel-based church is to know the forgiveness and love of God in Jesus Christ. It's to understand our fellowship as a company of redeemed and forgiven sinners, rather than as an association of perfect people. One of our maladies in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is the tendency of an ancient Anabaptist notion of the church to creep into our self-understanding, one that likes to define ourselves in terms of the truly orthodox, the right-believing, the pure church. And anyone who isn't pure or isn't fully orthodox becomes then the object of our search, our exposure, embarrassment, expulsion, words like that begin to enter in. Yes, there's a role in the church for a truly law-gospel discipline. It's part of our life together. We learn that from the New Testament. But to be a gospel-based church is to live in and of and for the forgiveness of sins. I stand here not as a perfect person, nor do you sit here that way either. We are here as forgiven people, saints and sinners simultaneously. I mean, we're not the saints and they're the sinners. We're all saints, sinners simultaneously. To be a gospel-based church is to be a church that knows something about celebration and joy. That's why I like the theme of the Synod. It's singable. I find myself singing, "Tell everyone what he has done." And doing that responsively, that is, in response to God's gift in the sacrament, after hearing the word of good news. We sing it because we're forgiven, because we have God's power, because his word stands sure. Therefore, we will fear not, as Professor Schmelder reminded us this morning. That kind of emphasis in this church cannot be stopped. The gates of hell cannot prevail against that kind of message. And it is needed as it was never needed before. Really, your preparation as pastors of the church is preparation in the understanding of that gospel. Church history, Dr. Luther used to say, is the story of how the dear gospel has fared in all the world. And systematics is ultimately the unpacking of it, how it all fits together, how it coheres in Jesus Christ and his good news. Exegesis has the task of enabling us to mine from the scriptures themselves in God's own words the message of the God who enters history in order to redeem it and save it and lead it. and practical theology helps us to understand better the gospel as it is proclaimed and taught and centered in our worship. So, my brothers, I stand here more as preacher than as anything else, I suppose, but to say to you that in my pastoral office, which has been keeping me very, very busy again of late, 2 weeks ago in Eastern Europe, next week in South America, yesterday in Pennsylvania, Sunday in Iowa, this afternoon and tomorrow in Wisconsin, visiting with, talking to, listening to God's people, especially his pastors. It's the gospel that we're all about. And I say with some conviction that a kind of new gospel dynamic is sweeping through this church again. I began to sense it in strong ways in the 1989 convention and in many of the things that began to happen afterward, as this church consciously has sought to focus on gospel and the mission of Jesus Christ, helping congregations and focusing our activity on people, not on institutions and programs and all of that. It's all over the place. We have problems. We have difficulties. I just read an article last night when I got home and looked through the mail in one of the publications that again describes this church in terms of perhaps having a terminal illness. That's not the church I'm a member of, and observe out there, I must tell you, it's a good church. It's a church where pastors and people are consciously striving to preach and proclaim the gospel of God in Jesus Christ, and they're beginning to understand the power and the dynamic that is in that kind of message preached and proclaimed and confessed and held again and again and again. So, I'm very, very glad you are here. I really am. I pray for you, your faithful professors who do their work in unsung ways many times, but who help you to get a window in on this Word of God that centers in Jesus Christ and his good news, the true treasure of the church. And I commend you young men, and some not so young anymore, who have chosen the ministry as your life's vocation. May it be a blessing to you, and may God help you as you prepare, taste and enjoy the kinds of things that come out of knowing that Jesus Christ forgives even you and even me, and each day cheers you on with that good news. And I am praying for you and for all of us in this church that together we can find more effective and better ways of telling everyone what he has done. Well, I would be very happy to quit doing all the talking and let you do some of it at least. Perhaps that you feel like I've stopped in the middle of a sermon and it's always hard to ask questions of the preacher after the sermon, but please don't do that. And if your first question is, when did you stop beating your wife, that's okay too. Let's just have a good visit. I know there are many questions about events in the church, directions in the church, your own role in the church. A lot of buzzing these days about the doctrine of the ministry and issues like that. Who would like to lead off? And I don't know whether, Dean Smith, do you want to watch the hands? Or, I probably won't be able to cover the waterfront. I don't think it would be a negative effect. I think that it the hope is not only at River Forest but at Mequon, which has also announced a university nomenclature for itself. I think the hope is that the name will help to attract funds that aren't otherwise available from certain foundations, that it may be a factor in a positive decision to attend there. I'd be very frank to tell you, I'm not personally greatly enamored of the change of name from college to university, although at River Forest I think there has been a gradual development in that direction for several years, and they are organized that way. But I don't see a negative effect on enrollment. I hope it will be positive. It wasn't this year. but let's hope that it will be.
You mentioned you went to Eastern Europe 2 weeks ago. What do you see, what are your ideas or plans of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in Eastern Europe?
Okay. Oh, I was hoping somebody would ask me that. Well, let me just, it was a quick trip. I was there only a week. I asked a number of, well, the event that caused me to go was a convention in Klitten, East Germany, a little town. Manfred, do you know where, it's a village, do you know where Klitten is? Down in the southeastern corner, not far from Poland and Czechoslovakia, in a church building that was built in 1847, and from a part of Germany where the Wendish immigrants came to the United States in the mid-19th century, especially in Texas. I know some of you may be Wendish background. Phil Holy on the camera is of Wendish background, and we saw names like Kieschnick and Simank in the cemetery. Over here we have some live ones. I'm not so sure whether they did there. But Klitten, it was an interesting story, if I may digress a little bit from the question. I'm told that 3 or 4 years ago, when the so-called Alt-Lutherische Kirche, the Old Lutheran Church, one of our partner church in East, partner churches in East Germany, decided to have its convention, the government in East Germany had just decided that this church in Klitten had to be destroyed, and the area around this beautiful old church. They do, what do we call that, strip mining, coal mining in that area, and that there's apparently an oil, a coal field underneath the church and cemetery and in that area. So at the last convention, they said, well, we can always have a synodical convention, but we won't always be able to meet in beautiful Klitten. And one of God's ironies in history, now they will no longer have any synodical conventions because they voted to merge with Selk, the church that Dr. Rentsch is a member of, professor of, and the church will be allowed to stand. So they have rescinded that order. So it was a very, very special convention. This brings together, by the way, two parts, you might say, of Missouri's mother church in Germany. And that's why it was especially fitting for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to be there, to thank these pastors for their faithful ministry for 45 years in East Germany. I think we have very little idea of how difficult that often was. But also to celebrate with them the reunification not only of their country, but also of the church. But on the way into Klitten, I had invited the presidents of some of our partner churches in Europe to sit for a day and a half in Berlin, and also invited Dr. David Daniel to join us. Some of you may know David and perhaps had him in class. I imagine there are some of you around. He is currently working in Bratislava, Czechoslovakia, doing some teaching at Comenius University, working for the government in terms of educational activities of the government. And our Board for Mission Services has recently asked David to help us identify areas in Europe, especially Eastern Europe, where we can be involved. Well, we came together for a day and a half to talk about the challenges and opportunities of the new Europe for confessional Lutheranism. Quite likely we will be having a larger meeting in 1991, to which we hope to invite a number of people that are not formally affiliated with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but who in some countries have become known to us as people who are very much interested in not only retaining confessional Lutheran doctrine, but in proclaiming and teaching it and sharing it in Eastern Europe and beyond. There are all kinds of things that could be said about observations in Eastern Europe, but our synod hopes to move in new and strong ways in partnership, especially with Selk, our strongest partner church in Europe, in finding new avenues and new opportunities to provide materials, perhaps to use the media effectively, to establish people-to-people contacts, a presence here and there in major cities of Europe where materials can be published, workshops can be held, and the like. It's a mistake to think that what Eastern Europe needs is money. That's the usual American solution, send money. My impression is that that's not needed so much as, first, our prayers, second, our involvement, our person-to-person contact, and our assistance in materials, in proclaiming and telling and educating and distributing simple, simple things on the gospel. It's very striking for me, who have always grown up thinking that everybody in Europe was baptized, to find that 30% in East Germany are not baptized. More than that, you think? What was the statistic they said in Erfurt, the city where Luther went to university, how many just pagans there are in Erfurt. Berlin has been witnessing a Muslim revival, or growth, I guess you should say, for several years. It's ironic that the continent of Europe, which in some sense gave Christianity to the New World, we are debtors to European Christians in the Missouri Synod, but that it today must again be seen as a mission field. P.S. So is the United States, let us not forget. So I don't know. It's just one more door that God is opening in special ways. There is a tremendous, I'll just say this, there's a tremendous interest in the Missouri Synod about Europe. Every pastor's conference I go to, including yesterday's, wants to know how we can do what they call hands-on contact with German churches and German church life. So we're going to be looking very, very hard at exchange programs at the seminary level and college level, congregational level, for pastors, for laymen, and I hope that will be helpful in spreading the gospel.
How much of a threat are we facing in that area from cult activity, and how much of a window do we have then as far as spreading the gospel before they become the problem?
I'm told that cult activity is very, very strong in East Europe and Western Europe as well. That there is a spiritual hunger in Europe is not at all denied by anybody. But the presidents I met with, and as well as Dr. Daniel, emphasized how active a number of sects and cults are in Europe, and that they are gaining a following. I don't know, Manfred, whether you've had any experience with the growth of sects and cults in Europe these days, but there is a tremendous concern about them and the clarity of gospel witness. And though it sounds a bit presumptuous for Missouri Synod to say it, the theology of many of the Western churches in Western Europe, the Lutheran churches, is not strong, in the state church system. It's no accident that much of what you read in Lutheran literature about peace and justice issues comes from Europe, as well as some Lutheran churches here in the United States. And I don't believe that a message of peace and justice is going to feed the spiritual hunger of Europe. Those who have met Lutherans behind the Iron Curtain have found them in these days especially to be quite strong in their basic beliefs in Jesus Christ, rather simple, quite pietistic at times. But our Journey Fest people who went to East Germany and Poland in August, came back with stories about Polish Lutheranism that are very, very heartwarming, very strong and very vibrant. Footnote there. It appears from some people that in Poland, Lutherans are as concerned about Roman Catholicism as we are about the aftermath of the socialist state. Lutherans are not treated very well, to put it mildly, in Poland.
I had a question concerning the United States as a mission field. Mankind is typically a religious being and knows that there's a creator or something that he needs to fill this void in his life, and will often come up with his own worldview, be that deism or naturalism or something to fill that. What is the church doing, or what can the church do in order to show these people that the need which seems to be fulfilled is actually not. You know, even if it has fulfilled their need up until the point that they die, it doesn't really. And how can we show that to them that they still have the need and then provide the gospel as the answer?
Well, I suppose there is no simple answer to the how, but surely a big step in that direction is to recognize that. It's a strange country, ours. Just again this week on a plane going somewhere, read the summary of the latest Gallup findings on religion in American life. You know, and once again, these strange statistics that show that Americans in very high numbers believe in God. You know, 90%, 80%, as I recall the statistic, roughly at least, believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, they say. High statistics in terms of the basic beliefs of people. It's clear that there are more people expressing beliefs in God and Christ than belong to all the churches combined, so that believing and belonging are quite different things in the United States. Then the puzzle continues. Of those who do belong, the difference that seems to make in moral conduct and behavior, you know, little things like shoplifting, lying, cheating on income tax, as far as they can tell from surveys, there's absolutely no statistical difference, by and large, between belonging Christians and non-Christians in society. Well, what does all this say? I mean, this country that we work in. And another part of it in the United States is that we are dealing with, and believe me, pastors out there just absolutely reaffirm this, we are dealing with a consumer-driven population in the United States. It's a pick-and-choose sort of Christianity that exists also for Lutheran Church Missouri Synod people. If they don't find what they like in a given congregation, move on to another one. Yuppies are coming back to church, they tell us, although some pastors see no evidence of it. But they're picking and choosing. The first church they may look at may be a Missouri Synod church if they grew up there. But if this Missouri Synod church doesn't have the best youth program in town, why, goodness sakes, join over there. And belief is not always the factor in determining belonging. That's a strange thing. I've met pastors in the Missouri Synod just in the last month or so, two of them, who told me that they had just encountered something new in their membership, each of them the same story, in a sense. They have a member who belongs to two churches in the same town. One is a church with the best youth program, and they have two teenagers, so they join over there, and in good American fashion, you support what you belong to. So they go over there a couple times a month and send a check over there, but they don't want to drop their membership in the Missouri Synod, so they go there and contribute there too. And you keep running into more and more people, Christian people, who will say things like, well, you know, what I like about the Lutherans is their strong school system. And I like their liturgy. I like the way the preachers preach good Bible-based sermons. Now, I never did go along with them on communion, you know, or baptism. But we still belong there because we like the other things. I mean, you find people who are kind of putting together their own program. So recognizing the fact that the church out there and the non-churched population is today made up of an incredibly different kind of mix of attitudes and options from what it might have been 50 years ago or 100 years ago, maybe even 20, is the first step, I believe, to doing what your question asks, namely, how do you give a clear witness in all of that? One thing it seems to me is clear is that the teaching function of the pastoral office has never been more in demand, more in need than right now. We are called as never before to help people know Jesus Christ and his gospel. And for someone who used to test people on the Latin terminology of the three uses of the law and things like that, that's important. Study hard and know it. But don't think that the task when you get out there is to teach the niceties of these complex theological ideas. Let your understanding of those complex theological ideas reinforce the clarity and the power that you bring to teaching the basic truths of the forgiveness of sin in Jesus Christ and all that surrounds that. So the teaching office of the church is very, very important. I don't know, there are other factors in what we must do, but that we must do it is for sure. The CTCR, in its last meeting, adopted an opinion on one or two aspects of the call in response to formal requests for those opinions from the Pacific Southwest Synod, and I believe the other was from the Commission on Judication, which had reference to the action of the Board of Regents with reference to Dr. Robert Preuss, whether an honorable retirement of a seminary president is consistent with the synodical doctrine of the call. And they've issued very brief opinions on that. I don't know whether they've been shared. Maybe some of you on the CTCR. I probably shouldn't be the communicator of the content. I had nothing to do with writing them. Apart from that, the CTCR, I don't believe, is directly involved in studies on the ministry issue. After the Wichita Convention took its action on lay ministry, it also passed a resolution asking for some continued study of questions that are related to that, including the possibility of second track for pastoral training. And that resolution was followed to the letter. A committee was put together. It is the committee that's, what is it called? It's a Standing Committee on Pastoral Ministry, which is tied in with the Board for Higher Education. And then that is augmented with, I think, four others who work in various connections to lay ministry. I understand that your own faculty has done some studying in that area, and I know that the Fort Wayne faculty has as well. There is a lot of buzzing in the church about whether or not the Wichita resolution on lay ministry was helpful or not. You read some rhetoric from time to time that makes it sound as though we denied the Augsburg Confession's 14th article, a statement that I think is categorically wrong. I don't know what prompts it. That I don't think happened. But whether the action was the best under the circumstances or not, I don't know. It's certain that there's a lot of studying going on. One of the things that we have to understand on that whole lay ministry question is what I guess the theologians would call the status quo ante, the way it was before that resolution was passed. For many years, we had a kind of an evolution of activity pertaining to lay ministry in this church. We knew at the time that the committee was created that there were more than 50 lay ministers engaged in word and sacrament ministries of one kind or another, and doing so officially. These are not mavericks. They were doing this in keeping with synodical policy that had been adopted in the early 70s. Well, when the committee came into being, they found that the number of 53 was inadequate. It was more like 120 lay ministers who are actually doing some kind of word and sacrament ministry. Surveys show that many of the congregations where that happens, they tend to be in outlying areas or in minority areas, but that in many of those congregations, the lay ministers are even called pastor by their people. And in some areas where state law permits it, they marry and carry on many of the official acts of the pastor. That was one question, you know, was this really the right way to go? Was it sufficiently when it was begun in the early 70s, I think it was a recognition that it could be done properly. We wanted to re-examine that. Then we had other things happening. We had five districts that were engaged in their own lay ministry training programs without any connection to anybody or anything in the Synod, with no standards, with no educational sameness or similarity between programs. We had a nomenclature problem. People were being called this, that, and everything. We had colleges introducing new lay ministry programs without any commonality. Our constitution and bylaws is set up in such a way that there was no real supervision of lay ministers, except from a neighboring pastor. But there was no ecclesiastical supervision of the doctrine and life of the lay minister. So all of these things came together, and came together at a time when Synod is taking a fresh look at ways in which we can start new work in minority areas, in inner city areas, in the Valley of Texas, where migrant workers congregate, in the ghettos and the boroughs of Manhattan. I talked to a pastor in Miami the other day who painted and wallpapered paths in my home when we moved off campus in 1981. Dennis Bartles, some of you may know him. I said, "How is your work going?" And he said, "Well, guess what? In our school, the children come from 32 different birth countries. 32. Well, how do you reach them?" And it's a church body that is capable of starting new work in over 300 places right now, if we had the people and the money to do it. So, do the laity of this church offer us an answer, working under supervision of pastors, to reach out? Those were some of the questions that prompted that study. I think the difficulty that most people have with it is, with what Wichita said, is that it seems to recognize what was going on before, namely that a lay pastor, a lay minister, and there's no such thing as a lay pastor, that a lay minister, under the supervision of a pastor, can be authorized to be his arms, so to speak, in administering Holy Communion under certain circumstances. And I think that has caused some to feel that there is a diminution in the understanding of the office of pastor in the Synod. Footnote, that's too long an answer to a nice, simple question. That particular question, though, is there a diminution in the understanding and appreciation of the office of pastor in the Missouri Synod today, is a very live question. And I don't know quite what all the factors are in that. There is some political cultivation of that notion. That's quite apparent that some want pastors to believe that. But it's nevertheless a felt need. It's a perception there that we need to deal with. So I would personally be very much opposed to any activity or understanding that would diminish the divinely instituted character of the pastoral office or of its distinctive episcope in the life of God's people. And I would just hope that the faculties and the pastors and the CTCR and all of us as we study this can keep our cool, keep our poise, keep our reverence under the word and our recognition that some people with different answers to these questions are still our brothers and are not intrinsically false in trying to give answers. We have always, it seems to me, in the history of Lutheran theology, at least since the 19th century, had to walk a line that was neither the kind of sacramental, sacerdotal understanding of a Vilmar or a Leahy on the one hand, comes very close at least to making ordination a sine qua non for administration of the means of grace, or the opposite extreme, the ditch on the other side of a purely functionalist notion that a pastor is kind of a hired man, hired by the congregation on the strength of their universal priesthood, with no distinctive institution of that office by God. Walther's position, as I'm sure Dr. Schmelder would like to. I've just given you another honorary degree, Bill. I do that every year too, because I know how you appreciate those. But Walther's position on that particular issue was somehow neither of those extremes, maintaining the divine institution, but also recognizing that the function of the office is tied into word and sacraments. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think that's ridiculous. I don't know. It was, I thought when that was, I was in the room when that was distributed in a Council of Presidents meeting, and it was received as more of a joke than anything else, you know, that this was not really serious. But then it became a little bit serious, I mean, because people were saying, well, when a pastor, for good reason, changes his vocation, as sometimes we encourage them to do. But that should happen, you know, as I say, when it's done for good reason. If it's done for moral cause or done for false doctrine reasons or something, then it's hardly a case for rejoicing. But in some cases, it's simply a matter of vocational preference or vocational choice that ought to be recognized by the church somehow as okay. You know, some of these people who leave the Amt carry a burden around that they have betrayed their trust or something, and there might be merit in something like that, but a diploma of dismissal, I believe, or whatever that was called, is most unfortunate. And as is often the case with things like that that you read about, if you knew the whole story and had heard the whole presentation and had received all the other paper that was handed out by Dr. Zones of the committee that presented it, and had been a part of the council's discussion for the last 5 years on the doctrine of the ministry, you'd know that that council is not pushing that. Something was handed out. It is not the case. But what the council is also trying to say there is that, in that larger discussion, is that pastors receive their call through the agency or instrumentality of a congregation. They don't become a pastor, don't receive a call by the synodical president's appointment or a district president's appointment or a consistory in the church, as is done in some church bodies. But as we understand the doctrine of the call, it's a congregation that calls. And they're also trying to say that the counterpart to that, then, that it's also a congregation that can and has the authority to dismiss a pastor, not at will, not without cause, but that it's still a congregation that must do that. The president of synod, the district presidents, cannot remove a man from the office of the ministry. And there's a lot of confusion on that. District presidents, not I. District presidents can remove, ultimately, from membership in the city, in the synod, which pastors hold, but they cannot actually remove the man as pastor of St. James Congregation or something. So we have been trying to underscore that the responsibility rests with congregations to call, and if there is cause, also to dismiss. A lot of the debate is on what is proper cause for dismissal.
My comment is related to your a few minutes ago about the lay training program. In my estimation, there is almost a danger, I think, hidden danger within the some kind of all types of programs, of training programs within the church body, such as seminaries, colleges, and district level and something like that. Now, I think training programs, this order or disunity in the training program may cause tremendous problems. I know this in other parts of the world, I'm not just in America. And then I'm thinking about while you were making comment, TEE program, theological education by extension. I heard that lately that particular program has been semi-adopted, officially adopted, and then handed over to the commission, one of the commission. My question is that type of decision will certainly add more problems. Another program, something like that. Now, my more positive side is why don't we diversify our choice training program within the context of two theological seminaries? Yeah. We have beautiful campus, faculty members, and everything possibly needed, you know, we have that. Now, and then, it's not just keeping up the classical training program of DMIN program, but other MD programs, excuse me, but diversified program in order to meet the needs of such as TEE needs and then other lay training programs, like or even minority programs and the like. I think we are sinners, if I may say so, it may sound very presumptuous, we may face a tremendous amount of problems in the future and tension within the church by proliferating almost endlessly, you know, here and there, all kinds of programs, and I don't know how we can control about that. So I think still the solution is in the hands of seminary prayer programs. The point is whether we can do it or not, that's another question. But I think our seminaries can do it. With their facilities, their prestige, and their faculties or something like that. I think this is like a crucial problem, maybe above any other program, I mean problems today.
I think the fundamental suggestion that I hear coming from your comments, Dr. G, is one that I agree with. In fact, I don't know when I visited with leaders of this seminary faculty and the other seminary faculty at Fort Wayne about 5 years ago and made the point loud and clear that something was happening in lay ministry, that if we didn't get leadership in the area, in the synod, it would happen whether we did it or not. I mean, that's the kind of things an administrator in my position has to work with. I knew of a conference that had just been held in the southwest part of this country where people on their own were planning to start a new pastoral training program for Hispanic workers. And I remember suggesting to seminary leaders at that time that if the seminaries don't own this particular concern and opportunity and make it their own, that we will really have difficulties. Now, how can the seminary do that when it is as poorly funded as it has been? I suppose would be one argument. But I believe that we must not give up on that. Seminary theologians, seminary leaders, seminary boards need to be involved in all of these questions. I'm not as negative as you are on TEE. Theological education by extension has been used fairly responsibly in Central and South America. I'm going next week to Sao Paulo, where the theological education people and presidents of our partner churches there will again share some of the things they're doing in the area. It is not as good a program as a resident seminary program, but it is better than no program at all for people who want to train people to preach the word without having them lose their cultural identity. But that too needs to be coordinated, just as you are doing through your faculty now in some of the Hispanic work and some of the Hispanic programs. It's a very, very important and crucial time for theological education, as I see it in the Missouri Synod. Even this week, in the midst of a lot of travels, I've had one conversation with a board member who is saying again, Synod should never have discontinued the practical seminary. You know, that we should never have, in a sense, we have in Fort Wayne and St. Louis two seminaries with pretty much identical programs. They're MDiv programs, slightly different requirements and so on, but that the old Springfield way of coming at it was not all bad, and that maybe we should do that. The increasing attention needs to be given to the 21st century in terms of theological education. You know, I'm about to suggest to, I don't know which committee, but a very thoroughgoing study as to whether or not we need another seminary for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on the West Coast in the 21st century. A seminary that is, while it would have walls, would not be limited to its walls, but is free to move out and among the people. We need new models of seminary training. And that is not because people are negative toward our current seminaries, so much as the changes in our society and the configuration of people and the fact that we're becoming an immigrant culture, forcing us more and more to some innovative approaches. And the seminaries, I would just repeat that, seminary faculties need to own this and not stand on the outside and scold the church for trying to do it. There is a perception in the church that the seminaries are against this kind of thing, or that they are not truly interested in mission. Well, you know as I know that that is not true. It must be very painful to hear that again and again. But you counter that perception by activity in concert with the folks at the International Center, because believe me, as one who's worked in both places, we need both dimensions in that decision. I've already had conversations with Dr. Johnson. I think he shares the sort of hope and dream that I've just been talking about. And I think it's going to be a fun time as we try to do these things responsibly. We're out of time, says this man. How about that? Well, I surely thank you for coming and staying. And for the work you're doing and preparing, I hope you find much joy and fulfillment in your ministry one day, but already here, in encouraging one another, so long as it is called today, Hebrews chapter 3. God bless you and make you a blessing to our church.